Welcome to Outdoor by Four Magazine's audio edition of Issue 54. For those unfamiliar with Outdoor by Four, the magazine began its journey as a fully independent, vehicle-based adventure and outdoors lifestyle publication in 2013. Since that time, Outdoor by Four has been the catalyst for expanding the reach of overland and vehicle-based adventure travel into the outdoors market, with a focus not only on the mode of travel, whether a 4x4, motorcycle, bicycle, or by foot, but also on the adventures themselves and the people who live them. In this issue, you'll hear a sampling of stories from Outdoor by Four's print edition, including Loving the Lava Life, a two-wheeled adventure in the shadow of Mount St. Helens, Blast from the Past, Vintage Trucks in the Land of Ancients, Havasu Adventure, a bucket list journey on the Havasupai Reservation, and Exploring the Past, exploring the history and trails in the remote backcountry of Eastern Oregon. There are also a variety of additional stories in this issue you can read by picking up a copy or by subscribing and receiving a copy as part of your subscription order at www.outdoorx4.com. We hope you enjoy this issue of Outdoor by Four Magazine. The Dispatch by Frank Ludwell, Editor-in-Chief. In the years following our independence from Britain, a movement began that encouraged homesteading and westward migration as part of the newborn nation's desire to expand its footprint, whether through the acquisition of land, for example the Louisiana Purchase, or by conquering the peoples and territories along this track. Through time, the General Land Office, GLO, was created to support these goals and evolved its role as the country continued its expansion. In 1849, the Department of the Interior was formed to take charge of the nation's internal affairs. By 1872, the founding of the country's first national park, Yellowstone, acted as a catalyst for nations around the globe to subsequently create national parks in the interest of preserving lands for public use and for the protection of wildlife and natural resources. As additional national parks and historical sites were carved from federal lands previously managed by a variety of internal agencies, including the War Department and the Department of Agriculture, it became apparent there would be a need for an agency to oversee those specific efforts. Thus, the National Park Service was born in 1916. 30 years later, during the Truman administration, the GLO merged with the Grazing Service to form the Bureau of Land Management, an entity that today is responsible for managing nearly one-tenth of our land base, while also conserving natural, historical, and cultural resources. Of course, this is an abbreviated history of how our nation's 400-plus national parks and public lands have become what they are, and the tens of thousands of federal employees who have worked tirelessly to ensure their preservation. That is, until late January 2025. What has taken over 200 years to develop, not without substantive challenges and changes in attitudes and motivations, is now under attack by fellow citizens who undervalue fact and history and overvalue the economic impact of slashing the resources required to allow proper and safe management of the natural resources we all enjoy. A one-size-fits-all approach to governance now threatens the entirety of the interior of our great nation and not only puts our nation's resources at risk, it also has an immediate impact with substantially limited resources to provide the variety of safety and management initiatives necessary at national parks, on public lands, the subsurface of those lands, and our general welfare. And if you don't follow or agree with what I'm presenting, take a trip to any location managed by either the Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, Forest Service, or other entity within the Department of the Interior. You'll find significantly longer lines to enter these spaces, basic services such as garbage disposal and operational needs slash, and confusion as to who and what should be handling a myriad of responsibilities. In short, it's becoming chaotic and certainly not the vision entrusted upon those who have worked tirelessly and with sacrifice to provide each of us with a common desire to continue as a beacon of prosperity around the world. If you value the rights you have as stewards of this great nation, speak up and demand a new trajectory that values collaboration with differing opinions to ensure what we do today leaves our children and grown children a tomorrow worth continuing to sacrifice for. Otherwise, what has made our national parks and lands management system a bright light for others to emulate will soon be a flickering light that diminishes into darkness.
Since 2017, 23Zero has been a leader in the ever-evolving Overland market. Whether it's high-quality products such as rooftop tents, awnings, or a variety of camp life gear, 23Zero is all about delivering adventure with a made-better principle, opting on better products, not cheaper ones. If you're looking for quality gear to get you into the backcountry and back, look no further than 23Zero. Visit them at 23Zero.com.
Loving the Lava Life, a two-wheeled adventure in the shadow of Mount St. Helens. Words and photos, Nicholas Bratton. The word epic is so widely used today that its meaning has been diluted. When once it denoted Trojan Wars or the quest to reach the South Pole, now it describes daily experiences. So, I might have been skeptical when I read that the Ape Canyon to Plains of Abraham Trail on Mount St. Helens was rated an International Mountain Bicycling Association, or IMBA, epic. What did that mean? There was only one way to find out. Ride it. Two adventure companions joined my investigation. Now a search and rescue expert in Alaska, Frank Marley is a former military medic who served in Afghanistan. His idea of fun is scuba diving under Arctic ice. John Bradley is a retired mountaineering guide whose time on Denali and other peaks has helped him cultivate the art of suffering in style. Our trio works on a glacier in eastern Greenland, searching for a missing World War II plane and its occupants buried beneath an ice cap where sustained winds routinely surpass 60 miles per hour and storms last for days. If anyone has the credibility to assess a claim of epicness, these guys are connoisseurs of adversity. There was a twist. We didn't just want to ride this route, we wanted to do it with local vintage panache. 50 miles northwest of Mount St. Helens lies the city of Chehalis. From the late 1980s to the start of the new millennium, a nondescript factory on the outskirts of town produced the most innovative and coveted bicycles ridden during a golden age of mountain biking. Klein bikes were not only defined by brilliant engineering, unrivaled performance, and cutting-edge manufacturing techniques, they were also rolling works of art. With dazzling paint schemes like Mardi Gras, Gator Linear Fade, and Aurora, their responsive handling and oversized aluminium tubing made them the object of my desire as a teenage mountain biking fanatic. I saved up for 2 years to buy my first Klein in 1993, a Rascal model custom painted in Moonrise Linear Fade. I still ride it today, and still feel 17 when I do, but it would not be ideal for a rocky volcano. Frank, John, and I all rode our Mantras with their radical high-pivot full-suspension frames. In an era of downhill supremacy, the Mantra was unique for being designed to excel at going uphill, a strength we would need to ascend the 2,700 vertical feet on the 20-mile ride. We wanted to pay homage to this legendary bicycle by riding our Mantras up a mountain in the backyard of where they were built a quarter century ago. On the Friday trip down from Seattle, we detoured in Chehalis for a pilgrimage to the old Klein factory. Now a fenced-off medical laboratory, we weren't sure we were in the right place. Then I saw it. Hanging in the upper floor window was a banner bearing the same Klein logo emblazoned on my Mantra. We had brought our bikes back to their birthplace. For three devotees of the mark, it was a life goal achieved. Now we had to complete the ride. An epic ride through terrain with an epic tale. May 18th, 1980 is a date forever etched in Pacific Northwest history. It's literally carved into the landscape. That morning, Mount St. Helens erupted, blowing 1,300 vertical feet off the mountain's nearly 9,700 feet of original elevation, scouring its slopes with pyroclastic flows and spewing an ash column that eventually scattered across the globe. The scars of that devastation, reminders of nature's fearsome power, still look fresh 44 years later. At 8:10 a.m. on Saturday, we embarked on our ascent of the Ape Canyon Trail, weaving through dense evergreen forest. The route skirts the edge of the blast zone, peeping out over the swath of destruction from a pyroclastic flow that gouged the mountainside like a giant ice cream scoop. The massive hulk of the volcano loomed through recent wildfire haze as if it was still smoking from the eruption. The smooth trail climbed steadily among the firs and ferns, our heart rates also climbing as we each sank into our own mantras to maintain upward momentum. Our heavy packs didn't make it easier. With no water on the route, we each carried 3 liters and shared the load of Frank's camera setup, along with tools, spare tubes, and food. As we rounded a corner, we felt like we had ridden through a portal. The trees vanished and before us lay a barren, rocky, broken landscape. We emerged from a temperate rainforest into a Martian desert. Behold, the Plains of Abraham. Now exposed under an expansive sky, we picked our way over a transformed trail. Gone was the soft carpet of the cozy understory. The new terrain was piles of shattered lava and pumice, sharp and loose. We hiked our bikes over boulders and through chasms chiseled by superheated rivers of mud and rock. The Plains of Abraham spread before us. We pedaled in awe through the echoes of the eruption that, with the equivalent of 26 megatons of TNT, seared all life from the slopes. Although the intensity of the climbing abated, we now labored over a trail whose surface was the consistency of granola. The narrow tires that augmented our mantra's nimble handling lacked the flotation to power over the pumice pebbles. Traversing back across the desolate scree below the smashed crater rim, we encountered uphill traffic, a couple of bike packers carrying overnight gear. Our exertion now felt paltry by comparison. The Ape Canyon descent made all the toil worthwhile. Leaning into the turns and sweeping through the forest, I imagined myself as an orange pyroclastic flow. The uphill climb had a few tricks on the way down as well. The thrill of zooming along that pristine trail on my beloved relic brought an eruption of joy. The smile shared by Frank and John at the trailhead told of a similar experience. With abundant daylight remaining, we changed out of our cycling gear and hiked down the nearby trail to Lava Falls. A rushing creek cascaded down cliffs of basalt pillars. We found a safe place for a dip in a side channel's pool, gasping as the glacial melt washed the volcanic dust from our sweaty arms and legs. We explored the inside of the volcano the next morning, hiking a mile and a half through the lava tubes of Ape Caves. Formed when the exterior of a lava flow cooled and solidified, leaving the hot interior to drain away, the pitch-black passages were the plumbing of the volcano. I felt claustrophobic after the vast Plains of Abraham, but the haunting acoustics of the caverns were worth the price of admission. Note, advance reservations are required. Exhausted from a solid weekend of action with a spectacular ride as its crown jewel, we debated the description of the trail on the way back to Seattle. Was it epic on the scale of the first ascent of Everest or the Odyssey? Not even close. But in its own way, though, it was something better. Three middle-aged adventurers could enjoy it astride their locally made vintage mountain bikes, an antiques off-road show. If an epic involves appreciating each other's company and witnessing an incomprehensible natural power stamp endure on a magical landscape, this ride deserves the rating.
Shop America's only integrated soft truck bed system. A load-rated rack plus a 100% waterproof canvas cap. The Wild Top is the ultimate cargo space maximizer. Number one in accessibility, giving you complete access on all sides, and number one in versatility. The Wild Top protects your gear underneath and carries everything you need from worksite to campsite on its patented top rack. Plus, you get an industry-leading 2-year warranty backed by 30 years of ingenuity in the truck accessory industry. Free shipping going on now at wildtop.com. That's wild-top.com.
Blast from the past. Vintage trucks in the land of ancients. It was 5 in the morning, and about time we were on our way. We weren't running late by any means. It's just that we'd been talking about this trip for several years, and now the engines were warm, coffee hot, and we were ready to roll. We were pretty excited to be taking these old trucks out for a little adventure. Slipping out of Norman, Oklahoma into the quiet darkness of a November morning, with just the streaming center line of a 2-lane highway on which to focus, I became comfortable with the idea of pushing my old FJ43 on another long trip. These trips didn't always go as planned. You can read about that in issue 38. This one might be different. At least I hope so. We were a convoy of 3 vintage trucks, 2 mechanics, and 4 smiling faces with a single purpose: to have some fun. Bill Dragoo was driving his recently restored 1976 patina blue Land Cruiser FJ40. You can read about that restoration in issue 53. I piloted my mostly reliable 1981 red FJ43. A South American coffee plantation transplant from Colombia by way of Oregon. Chuck Anderson, a.k.a. Mr. Fix-It, was managing logistics and spelling drivers. A lifelong passion for Austin Healey's had turned Chuck into a great mechanic. He really shines when things break, and he has shone brightly on more than a few occasions riding with me. Lastly, Jim Cox, close friend and life of the party, was the odd man out, driving his single-owner Jeep CJ7. Now, with over 200,000 miles, it became his daily driver back in 1983, right after he got out of dental school. Like most good friends, we hold some important things in common. Love for old vehicles, desire for adventure, and a thirst to see what might lie around the next corner. Driving these old trucks with their obvious mechanical simplicity and durability does something for your soul. It's an immersive, unfiltered experience that connects you to the road and the spirit of adventure, making you feel more alive by stripping away distractions, empowering you, and enhancing your sense of wonder. All of this results in a greater sense of freedom and an appreciation for the simple things. But mostly it spreads a big smile across your face. The plan, as simple as a carbureted straight six. Look for roads less traveled, visit ancient places, camp in primitive sites, occasionally sleep in historic hotels, cook our own meals as often as possible, and simply enjoy the drive. Our target was Chloride Canyon, a favored destination in southwest New Mexico. With impromptu explorations along the way and plans beyond the canyon determined as weather and our collective wanderlust dictated, all told, we would travel 2,000 miles over 8 days. A mere 50 miles would be on four-lane highways, avoiding populated areas as best we could. Early on, we found our way onto old Route 66 and its precursor, the Ozark Trail. In our attempt to recreate the classic American journey, Chuck guided our convoy down our own mother road, past historic buildings and nostalgic landscapes. First days are always long. Driving westward out of one night and into the next, we covered 538 miles in a cold, rainy soup. Headlights reflected off dark, wet pavement until the sun's rays penetrated graphite skies. We departed Oklahoma and passed through the Texas Tablelands and onto the flat and uninterrupted Llano Estacado. We drove in and out of rain all day, entering New Mexico by late afternoon. As night hunted us down, the sun slipped behind silhouettes of distant mesas and the horizon became a molten ribbon of orange. That familiar cloak of darkness enveloped us again on our desolate two-lane highway, illuminated by the lonely glow of our headlights. Our radios fell quiet as we were swallowed up by the night. We were on our last legs as we pulled into the small town of Willard, New Mexico. A hearty dinner at the Willard Cantina and Cafe fueled us for the handful of miles to the Schaefer Hotel in Mountain Air. The Pueblo Deco-style hotel has served worn and weary travelers like ourselves since 1923. The manager had left our room keys on our beds and asked us to slip payment under the kitchen door. Good thing they're so casual about such things because we were off again by 5:15 a.m. to locate the Abbo Franciscan Mission in Pueblo for a sunrise start to the second day. The Abbo ruins are a historical wonder dating back to the 14th century. They were a major trading station from their inception. The Spanish arrived in 1581 and by 1623 had begun construction of a church and mission. Interestingly, this first church incorporated a kiva, most likely assisting with early conversions. I was impressed that the mission architecture included this ancient ceremonial space within its walls. Reminders of stormy skies to the west and pastel orange and pink skies to the east greeted us at the mission, lighting up the surrounding peaks. We lingered around the ruins for a bit and were off to breakfast, still an hour away. What lay ahead for our group? More missions and mesas, cactus caverns and cave dwellings, petroglyphs and pueblos, white sands and red sunsets. New Mexico is home to so many ancient artifacts and monuments, and we had our sights set on those in the far southwest corner. We also looked to sample unique foods like piña nuts and hatch chili and find challenging drives along the way. New Mexico is a great place to experience from any vantage, but it seems most appropriate from the seat of a vintage truck. It's just that much more magical, and the truck seemed to hum a familiar, adventurous tune as we grew closer to the mountains, gravel roads, and night sky. Gila Forest. The Black Range, with its north-south orientation, forms the eastern boundary of the expansive Gila National Forest. Traveling west out of Socorro, we enter the forest from the north. The region's volcanic origins help explain a more colorful nickname, Sierra Diablo. Foreboding place names make for better adventure stories. We had finally traded our fast pace for a more intentional rhythm. Taking a cue from Edward Abbey, we turned onto gravel roads, skirted peaks shrouded in chilly winds and steely clouds, and ventured further away from the familiar and deeper into the unknown, becoming more aware of our surroundings and, hopefully, ourselves. Breathing the crisp Sierra Diablo air, we were busy making memories instead of time. Eyes wandered off-road and onto hills and peaks, scanning for wildlife, and, oddly enough, found a flat stretch of desert filled with giant satellite dishes. The Very Large Array, or VLA, outside Magdalena, is a system of 27 coordinated dishes on rails that comprise a radio telescope. The VLA is designed to be flexible in size, so it might listen to black holes and other interstellar whispers. I began to feel somewhat insignificant, and at the same time, closer to the vast reaches of our cosmos. The Cybertruck might fit in better with these dishes, but I prefer my old red tractor. After a final refuel in Winston, a regular stop in the New Mexico backcountry discovery route, we dove into Chloride Canyon, the only place circled on our map, by mid-afternoon. Pedal to the metal for 700 miles in a vintage truck is nothing to smirk at. Active steering, road noise, and all that grinning from ear to ear can test your fortitude. Driving through the canyon is probably a 2 on a scale of 1 to 5 in difficulty. With an occasional cow or oncoming truck to negotiate, the canyon has become undemanding for the most part. Sunshine illuminating yellow cottonwoods, rock formations towering overhead, and cool blue skies make for a perfect backdrop to a beautiful track. The drive through the canyon was not only easy, but it ended way too soon. Shifting into 4 low, we began to climb out. The first switchback is a steep one, fit for an old 4x4. Roaring along, flexing our muscles, we took the climb head-on, more smiles. That is, until Jim CJ7 let out the most awful metallic, hammering, grinding noise halfway up the incline. The only thing to do was power through the last bit of calamitous ascent, find level ground, and pull the parking brake. Whew. Testing the low range several times in both forward and reverse only reinforced our fears. It sounded like something was about to break. Jim shifted into two-wheel drive and limped into Camper's Cave, where we quietly set up camp to distract ourselves from the mechanical concerns. As the sun set, rain began to fall. It felt appropriate. Bill had replaced Jim's springs and secured a potentially dangerous exhaust leak prior to our departure, standard operating procedure for most vintage Jeep adventures. Unfortunately, this four-wheel drive issue wouldn't be the last time our convoy would experience mechanical problems. Snow camp in a cave. The temperature dropped and snow fell outside Camper's Cave as we huddled around a roaring fire and ate dinner. We were warm and dry as the snow blanketed our trucks and tents. After some quiet talk, we headed to bed. Sleep came easy as the snow transformed our tents into igloos. By morning, 2 inches of snow had covered everything in camp. Coffee and oatmeal warmed our bellies, if not our toes. The wintry scene made for a beautiful morning drive. A bit of good news. Jim's truck, now in two-wheel drive, had zero issues cruising the forest road as the sun did its best to melt the snow. Reaching State Road 59, we headed west, deeper into the Gila, toward Beaverhead Workstation, where we had seen helicopters landing during the previous fire season. The terrain provided several beautiful climbs as we headed south toward the Continental Divide, stopping occasionally to talk with passing hunters. Soon we found a nice campsite at the bottom of Black Canyon. A big campfire and good food and drink encouraged storytelling and lots of laughter as we discussed options for day 4. The good time was cut short as temperatures fell sharply after sunset. We headed to our quarters as the moist air settled into the low 20s. Frost covered our tents and windshields when we rolled out of bed the next morning. After a slow start, we packed up and prepared to head to the Gila Cliff Dwellings, which was even deeper into the wilderness area. The Gila, unique and diverse. The Gila Forest and Wilderness area is a unique place. Douglas fir and Engelmann spruce trees will remind you of the Montana Rockies, but glance across the creek and you might spy a prickly pear cactus, pinyon pine, or a javelina from more arid desert regions to the south. It can be confusing and illogical. The Gila is basically a crossroads ecoregion sitting between the Sierra Madre to the south and the Rockies to the north, stitching together the Chihuahuan and Sonoran deserts. Running westward through the National Forest is the Gila River, the southernmost snow-fed river in the lower 48. Grizzly bears were driven out years ago, but the Mexican gray wolf was reintroduced relatively recently in 1998. Cruising north into the wilderness, on the only access road to the dwellings, we glimpse the enormity of the Gila. A twisting, narrow, and well-maintained road takes you not only to the dwellings, but past some fun hot spring campsites. As luck would have it, we spotted a wolf. Smaller than its gray wolf cousins in Yellowstone, but stockier than a coyote, it loped along the road ahead of us, easily bounding into the forest and out of sight. Chuck and I were lucky to be in the lead at the time. It was a fantastic experience. The Gila Quick dwellings are not as large nor as intricate as those in the Mesa Verde National Park, but they are a wonder nevertheless. The ranger assured us there were other cliff dwellings located in more remote sections of the wilderness. As we roamed through the dwellings and by the petroglyphs, we decided to drive to Pinos Altos, get a meal at the Buckhorn Saloon and Opera House, and stay at Bear Creek Cabins. The restaurant has an authentic Old West saloon feel, and the Opera House is still in operation. After two cold nights, we enjoyed the warm showers and beds. Caravan across the sands. Our fifth day was more urbane. Stopping to resupply for a quick trip across the Chihuahuan Desert to Alamogordo, avoiding Interstate 10, we followed a less direct route through Hatch for some Mexican cuisine and down towards Las Cruces for groceries and gas, crossing White Sands at dusk to a campground at the foot of the Sacramento Mountains. Setting up camp, we watched the sun backlight the San Andreas and Oregon Mountains as another day ended. Gentle breezes turned to soft showers by daybreak, and we again packed up before sunrise to head east across the Sacramentos and down to Carlsbad. Our southern detour appeared to be a wise choice as snowstorms were ravaging the ski resorts near Santa Fe. White sands to snowy pass. Day 5 turned into more of an adventure than we had planned. Not more than 3 miles east of Alamogordo, the rain turned to ice, then snow, and we began to see cars off the side of the road. Tow trucks joined our convoy as we crept towards Cloudcroft. Shifting into four-wheel drive to better handle the slippery road, Jim's Jeep, as anticipated, responded with more clanging. Note, the hammering and grinding sounds Jim experienced in low range were due to two missing mount bolts. The initial torque caused the transfer case to rattle against the frame, and the drive shaft was grinding against it as well. This was discovered after returning home and removing the skid plate. Topping the climb in Cloudcroft, we noticed a young woman's vehicle off the road. She agreed to let us help, so Bill hooked up a line under her as Chuck climbed into the driver's seat. With some nifty winching and maneuvering, the team had her back on the road in a couple of minutes. With parting smiles, we were off and down the mountain. On the descent, Jim informed us his lights and radio were getting weaker. We had 100 miles to go to Carlsbad and the closest auto supply store. We figured the Jeep could make it. Mr. Fix-It shines. No matter the reason for a stop, fuel for the truck or driver, supplies, or a burrito stand in West Texas, someone invariably approaches to find out more about your truck, talk about the Land Cruiser they wish they had held on to, and share some advice or have a great day. That was our experience in the parking lot of the O'Reilly's, where we ordered a new alternator for the Jeep. You don't visit Carlsbad without checking out the cavern, so we took a touristy side trip while awaiting delivery of Jim's replacement alternator. Upon return, Chuck was able to make quick work of the alternator swap while Bill investigated a stubborn brake light issue. Built rugged, dependable, utilitarian, and long-lasting, these tanks just seem to keep going. However, at least once a day, it's advisable to extend a fuel stop to investigate fluid levels, odd sounds, new smells, and tire pressures. Repairs completed, we were on our way home. We passed pump jacks in the caliche-covered desert basin of New Mexico and transitioned into the greener Permian red beds of West Texas. Then a final day of travel took us through places like Spur, Texas and El Dorado, Oklahoma, with a stop at the Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge to investigate recent wildfire damage. Final thoughts. Our trucks fit right in, rolling through the rustic landscape of New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma, riding in these vintage trucks along ranch roads, in the mountains, and across deserts is such a unique experience. Their rugged charm provides a big dose of nostalgic adventure therapy. It's the kind of travel that leaves you deeply connected and appreciative. As the miles ticked away, and each turn revealed more and more familiar places, we realized our long-awaited adventure was coming to an end. Silence pervaded the radio waves as we anticipated reconnecting with our loved ones. It was a mix of melancholy and reminiscence. A big smile spread across my face as memories of the many vivid experiences from the past few days flooded my mind. Isn't that the way all good things should end?
The adventure is calling. Are you ready to answer? Front Runner Outfitters equips explorers, overlanders, and outdoor enthusiasts with rugged gear that takes you far beyond the beaten path. From durable roof racks to clever storage solutions and all the accessories you need, Front Runner Outfitters has you covered. Every product is built tough, tested in the wild, and ready to handle your next journey no matter where it leads. It's time to pack up and live your adventure. Explore our full lineup at frontrunneroutfitters.com.
Havasu Adventure, a bucket list journey on the Havasupai Reservation. Words and photos by Kathleen Bayer. Each year on the 1st of February, people log onto their computers, hoping to secure a permit to see Havasu Falls and camp on the Havasupai Reservation. These permits can be hard to get, but I was lucky enough to score one last summer. The moment I saw a photo of the blue-green waterfall and read about the challenging hike to get there, I knew I had to go. Havasu Falls is located deep within Grand Canyon National Park, on the land of the Havasupai people, who have populated the area for over 800 years. Every year, they allow visitors to camp on their land and experience the stunning beauty that surrounds them. Three friends were joining me, and as avid hikers, we were excited for the journey. We soon learned the hard way, however, just how hot it can get in Arizona, especially in June. We had to wait until school was out for the summer since one of us is a teacher, but we were all excited to take on the challenge. Preparing for this backpacking trip, especially in the heat, was essential. After securing our permits, we dove into training and gear prep. Being from Pennsylvania, where we have plenty of trees but no desert terrain, we had to get creative to simulate the rocky and elevated trails we'd encounter out west. We flew to Las Vegas, grabbed some last-minute supplies, and drove to Peach Springs, Arizona. Both the Grand Canyon Caverns and the Hualapai Lodge are about an hour from the trailhead, but since we needed to collect our permits and trip details from the former, we opted to stay there. As we checked in, the sky darkened under a thunderstorm. Summertime is monsoon season in Arizona, and thunderstorms can strike unexpectedly. The Havasupai Falls Facebook page, maintained by the Havasupai people, kept us updated on the storm. Thankfully, it hadn't reached their area, and we could proceed as planned. We set out from the hotel at 3 a.m., aiming to hit the trail by 4:30 a.m. This is crucial, especially in summer, to avoid the intense midday heat. Our 10-mile hike down to Supai and onto Havasu Falls and the campground entrance would take us 4 to 6 hours. Understandably, the return a few days later would take us 5 to 7 hours. The descent to and ascent from Havasu Falls is often compared to climbing up and down the Empire State Building. We descended into the canyon with headlamps and trekking poles guiding our way along rocky switchbacks. The long, tall steps we took down were challenging, and I kept reminding myself that what goes down must come up. The 360-degree views of the canyon lands that visibly emerged as time went on were incredible, though. The sunrise over the red rock landscape was absolutely breathtaking, and for a short moment, the sun sat to one side of us and the moon the other. Even in the early hours of the morning, we found shelter from the sun and increasing temperatures in the shadows of the canyon walls. Water is non-existent on the trail until you reach the village, so we made sure to carry at least a gallon of water each, plus electrolytes. We relied on evidence of foot traffic and mule manure to guide our way when the path was not clearly marked, and we optioned to follow dry creek beds at times since they were wider. Trail conditions turned from rough and rocky to sandy as we crossed into Havasupai territory, coinciding with the sound of rushing water. We soon caught our first glimpse of the crystal clear Havasu Creek. As we walked through Supai, we met a local who pointed out one of the oldest trees. He also explained how they get electricity and shared stories about the celebrities who have filmed movies there. Interestingly, the Havasupai Reservation is the only place in the United States where mail is still delivered by mule train. After making our way through the village, we trekked a couple more miles to the highlight of the trip, Havasu Falls. The roar of the falling water announced its proximity, but the sight of it was even more impressive than I had imagined, making the hard work of the hike even more rewarding. At 80 feet tall, the water crashes into a blue-green pool that is simply breathtaking in this rocky desert canyon environment. After soaking in the beauty, we continued our trek a few more miles to find a camping spot. Proximity to Mooney Falls was a priority since we planned to hike to the Colorado River the next day. We passed the 3 composting bathrooms along the trail, crossed a bridge over the water, and found a spot by the creek with a picnic table. In triple-digit temperatures, we spent the rest of the day swimming in Havasu Falls. The waters were cold but refreshingly perfect for the day's heat. Exhausted, we went to bed early, knowing we had a challenging hike ahead of us in the morning. The Confluence Hike, so named for where Havasu Creek meets the Colorado River, is an out-and-back trail that spans 16 to 20 miles. There are no trail markers, so it can be tricky to stay on course. But some hikers have piled up rocks or left markers with orange tape on tree branches to keep others en route. The descent to Mooney Falls is not for the faint-hearted. A sign at the beginning of the trail warns that you descend at your own risk. We climbed through 2 small caves and then rock climbs down, holding onto a series of chains, dropping 200 feet, all while being sprayed by the waterfall. If you're afraid of heights, you may want to reconsider. But what lies beyond is worth the challenge. The hike features several rocky climbs and ladders before reaching Beaver Falls, a serene and beautiful spot on the trail to the Colorado. We met a seasoned area hiker who showed us where to scale a small waterfall and jump into the water. Definitely a fun detour. The trail has 7 water crossings, and as we followed the creek, we eventually reached the river, where you see the contrast between the blue-green Havasu Creek water and the muddy Colorado. We took a break on the rocks, enjoying the scenery. We didn't linger too long, though. We still had the long return hike ahead. On the way back to the campground, we saw clouds rolling in and heard thunder in the distance. The weather can shift quickly in monsoon season, and we were mindful of the warning signs. As we approached Mooney Falls, we noticed the water had changed color, a sign that the storm was nearby. When we returned to our campsite, we found it deserted. Some campers told us that the ranger had warned everyone earlier in the day to move to higher ground due to the risk of flash floods. Fortunately, the storm passed without incident, but it was a reminder of how quickly conditions can change. A few months later, some hikers weren't so lucky. Flash floods swept through the campground, resulting in fatalities. If you plan to visit, avoid monsoon season for safety reasons. On our final day, we hiked back to the village and swam at Little Navajo Falls. Each waterfall in the area is unique, but nothing compares to the grandeur of Havasu Falls. The whole trip is a choose-your-own-adventure. There's so much to see, and it's easy to rack up 50 miles of hiking in just a few days. On our last night, we stargazed across the dark sky, packed up by 2:30 a.m., and began our trek out with the bats chasing the bugs lit by our headlamps, each swooping around us as we walked. We made it to Supai around 4:30 a.m. and started our ascent back up the rocky terrain to the hilltop trailhead. It's important to reach the final ascent of the switchbacks before the sun reaches them. We made it to the top by 8:30 a.m., and for the first time, I heavily relied on my trekking poles for assistance. This adventure was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my life. It was physically demanding, but it gave me the chance to fully appreciate the wild, untamed beauty of Arizona's landscape. It was nice to shut off for a few days from the distractions of modern life and just take in the scenery. How often do you get to experience something like that?
Loa began as a village cobbler in Bavaria in 1923. 102 years later, Loa is still based in that same village and is still crafting premium outdoor performance footwear under the world's most stringent environmental and labor standards. From mountaineering, backpacking, hunting, tactical and hiking boots to trail running shoes, Loa is recognized worldwide for the uncompromising quality, fit, and comfort that has made Loa boots simply more.
Exploring the past, history, and trails in the remote backcountry of Eastern Oregon. Words and photos, Eric Dalen. Friday morning, the rigs were packed and ready to go. Everyone we knew was headed for Overland Expo Pacific Northwest. Jeff and I, however, pointed our vehicles in the opposite direction. We headed out into the open expanses of Eastern Oregon. To some, the high desert of Eastern Oregon might seem open and empty, but nothing could be further from the truth. From the dunes of Christmas Valley to the towering rock formations of Leslie Gulch, Eastern Oregon has enough to explore to keep someone busy for a long time. My buddy Jeff and I were excited to go see what the Heart Mountain Range had to offer, since we had yet to explore that part of the state. Our main goal for this weekend excursion was to go and see the old abandoned Shirk Ranch located east of the Heart Range. I first learned of Shirk Ranch from videos that friends had posted on YouTube. The ranch looked well preserved, but I was also intrigued as to why anyone would want to live in such a desolate area. The nearest town is Lakeview, Oregon, 68 miles away. Jeff and I gathered some last-minute supplies from the store and trucked our way east on Highway 20, knowing we had a long haul on pavement ahead of us. As we drove along, we enjoyed the views of the buttes that rise out of the very volcanic landscape of Central Oregon. We cracked over the radio from time to time to point out vehicles we saw that we knew, just by looking at them, were headed to Expo. Sure, maybe we were missing out on some cool chats with people and seeing some sweet gear, but we knew the trails would be empty, and that was even better. Now midday, as we drew ever closer to our destination, we passed Lake Albert. Even though it's mostly dried up now, the sights were still amazing. To our left, Albert Rim stretched south on one side, and Coglan Buttes was to our right. It was an amazing view, and I felt it would have been more epic by evening light. The last 100 miles felt the longest. We were antsy to hit dirt. A surprisingly smooth dirt road finally led through the juniper bushes and long grass. Guano Lake followed along our right side, and we could see herds of pronghorns searching for food and water. Then just ahead, we could see a water tower poking up above a small hill. We pressed on another mile. The view opened up and the ranch spread out before us. David Shirk purchased the property in 1883 and constructed most of the buildings by 1910, and they still remain. Shirk raised horses on his land, even pulling and taming from the wild herds in the area. He was considered one of the best horse handlers in Oregon. Knowing this helped me understand why someone would live in such a remote place. The ranch's 8 buildings vary in size and purpose. Existing in such a far-flung place, I found it amazing that these wooden structures, over 100 years old, were still in pretty good shape. If I hadn't known otherwise, I would have assumed they had been built more recently. As we walked amongst the buildings, birds, who are now the main residents, flew in and out of the crevices in the woodwork. The peace and quiet really stood out. No planes droned overhead, constant traffic didn't buzz along the highways, no sirens from emergency vehicles blared. All everyday sounds back home in Bend. The silence felt intense, especially since I was accustomed to the noise of a city. We began to identify some of the buildings. The outhouse, yeah, an easy one, I know. The root house, bunkhouse, and the blacksmith shop. It was like a small town. Considering the nearest settlement was at least a 2-day journey by horse, it all made sense. Shirk needed to be self-sufficient. It makes me smile when I think about ways so many people nowadays try to be self-sufficient. Yet I suspect few have the capabilities of the people that once lived on the ranch. It was a way of life. They had to survive. They had few options. In the main house, we found artifacts from days long gone. Old magazines, a leather chair to relax in after a hard day's work, and some bottles I suspect once contained beer. You could almost hear footsteps and laughing from the ranch hands as they played billiards in the room above. The sun continued to track westward. It was time to say goodbye to the ranch and to some of the local cows if we were going to find camp for the night. It was time to venture into the Guano Creek Wilderness Study Area. The drive into the Guano Creek area was a steady climb. Large rocks became scattered about the road. Up to this point, we had been running high pressures in our tires, but with the changing conditions, we decided now was a good time to air down. I lowered my pressures tire by tire. When I reached my passenger rear tire, I found that a lug nut and stud were missing. Suddenly, the isolation hit me hard again. We were hours from any town where I could get a replacement. At least I still had 5 other studs, right? I put my fingers on the next lug nut just to see how it felt, and it fell off in my hand. Needless to say, I was a little worried. Thankfully, the other 4 felt tight. With no way to repair them, all I could do was keep driving and hope no other studs broke off. I drove a bit more carefully. Every time I hit a bump or rock, I cringed. Despite the mechanical situation, the views of the surrounding landscape looked amazing as the evening light bathed everything in a golden hue. We also came across a few water crossings, which, as anyone who does exploration by vehicle knows, added to the fun. Other dirt roads split off frequently, but with light fading and not knowing where they led, we stayed on the main trail. Despite looking here and there, we couldn't find a suitable camp, so we decided to sleep at a crossroad. We hadn't seen another soul since hitting dirt, so Jeff and I felt it wasn't going to be a problem. We enjoyed the evening with some bratwurst in front of a fire. With the ever-growing darkness, stars started to appear overhead. One of my favorite things to do when exploring is astrophotography. Sure, you can see a lot with the naked eye, especially away from city lights, but the vast number of stars a camera can capture with a long exposure is awe-inspiring. We awoke the next morning to clear skies and peaceful surroundings. After a few cups of French press coffee and a cinnamon roll, we packed up and continued north to see what other things we could find in the area. The main mission for this trip had always been the ranch, but now the unknown of the trail lay ahead, and that holds an excitement all its own. Old Military Road intersected with our route. Although we decided not to take it, we learned later that it was used to connect many of the military forts and camps back in Oregon's early days. One of the old forts, in this case more of a camp, lay just ahead of us. We drove into a small valley covered with scattered forests. As we traveled along, another trail led to the left with a sign that read, "Grave Sites." Jeff's voice came over the radio. "Let's go check it out." The windy road led to a clearing and 2 military gravestones that read, "Private Louis DeBold" and Sergeant Edward Cantrell. I looked at the inscribed names and wondered what had happened. I later learned that these graves were all that remained of the original site of Camp Warner. Established in 1866, the camp was moved to a different location just a little over a year later. I can only speculate as to why they moved it. Maybe, like many others, they found the place too remote and inhospitable. Even though it was a very beautiful setting, it was a somber reminder of how hard life was back in those early days on the Western frontier. We turned our rigs west, eventually, The dirt led back to pavement, and the pavement led us to Paisley, Oregon. Once there, we stopped at Chewaukan Garage, now known as Paisley Auto and Tow, to refuel. As I stood waiting for my gas tank to top off, a shop employee walked by, saw my passenger rear wheel, and said, "Someone's living on the dangerous side." I replied, "Well, funny you should say that. I wanted to see if you guys had any studs to fix it." To my relief, he was very helpful and had all I needed to fix the issue. With all my lug nuts and studs back in place, we could start home with greater peace of mind. In just a day and a half, we saw two amazing pieces of history in some stunning countryside. We felt there was much more out there to find, but that would have to wait for another trip. In the vastness of eastern Oregon, there would always be some gem waiting to be discovered. Perhaps that's one reason lone ranchers and homesteaders stake their plots and lives out there. Until then, we put the remote beauty in our rearview mirrors and headed for Bend, where friends, family, and the hum of city life waited for us.
This audio edition of Outdoor by Four is brought to you by Radius Outfitters. We all know how messy life and vehicles can get. That's why Radius offers rugged storage systems that protect and organize your essentials. From customizable storage boxes to kitchen organizers, Radius gear makes life at camp easier, so you'll be ready for anything, whether cruising with the family in the desert or kicking it solo in the mountains. Check them out today by visiting RadiusOutfitters.com.
Stay tuned for Outdoor by Four's issue 55, highlighting a myriad of stories that'll inspire you to step out and explore the world around you. Also, be sure to visit the Outdoor by Four website at www.outdoorx4.com regularly for new tips, reviews, and stories, and join our e-newsletter to stay in the loop on the latest from Outdoor by Four. You can also follow Outdoor by Four and the adventures of our staff and contributors on Instagram and Facebook at OutdoorX4, on TikTok and YouTube at OutdoorX4 Magazine, and by following the hashtag OutdoorX4. Until our next issue, we wish each of you the happiest of adventures.